London authorities, you may say that man would have a very inadequate perspective. You would have neither clocks nor timetables. You would have no essential knowledge of genealogies or chronologies. And all incidents of history would lose their perspective and their relationship. So man, whether he realizes it or not, is constantly using mathematics, either instinctively or as a result of accomplishment. So this evening, we want to extend our thinking a little further by discussing one of the most important of all the Pythagorean formulas, and that is the so-called 27th proposition of Euclid. A great many of you are acquainted with what has been called the Carpenter's Theorem. It is a very simple and very mysterious equation. And because of its intense symbolic interest to us, it seems that we should examine it and study it with some care. Before we do so, however, let us go back to a symbol which we discussed briefly in an earlier talk, namely the symbol of the dot in the circle. The dot in the circle gives us a primary symbolic figure to represent the three principal parts of the universe, or, as the Pythagoreans would have called it, the three principal parts of the divine nature. In the center is the dot, which to these ancient scholars and philosophers was an appropriate symbol of God. Therefore, center and God became more or less related symbols. The second important element is the imaginary line by the extension of the dot, which brings into existence the concept of radius. A circle is a center, a radius, and a circumference. Now, the radius to these peoples represented a middle distance, or a middle ground, between the center and the circumference. And by the circumference, they represented matter, or a hypothetical circle enclosing as a vessel the process of creation. Thus they had a center and a circumference, spirit and matter. And between these two, an extended radius or line, which was their melachord, the thread with one end attached to heaven and the other to the earth, upon which they created their great scientific theorem of the music of the universe. So we have a threefold division in the concept of man. This threefold division has existed from most primitive times. And among many old ancient peoples, we find the gradual emergence of a religious trinity. This trinity, which in Christendom is called Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or Holy Spirit, appears in nearly all other major religious theories. In India, we have the trinity composed of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And in the Buddhistic concept, we have the trinity consisting of Buddha, and then the two polarizations, wisdom and compassion. So truth, wisdom, and compassion become, so to say, the primary trinity in Buddhistic thinking. In the Persian philosophers, we also have the establishment of a triadic concept of being. And therefore, as Plutarch tells us, it was customary in ancient times to symbolize the divine nature in itself as an equilateral triangle. This equilateral triangle, the first letter of the Greek word for deity, also occurs in many religious and philosophical systems as a proper and appropriate emblem of deity. It so occurs on the reverse of the $1 bill of the United States, where it creates or forms the apex of a pyramid, and within the triangle itself is the all-seeing eye, the proper symbol of the divine being. For it is said that the God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. And in the ancient Kabbalah, we are told that the great being, the eternal God, has eyes but no iris, because he never sleeps. Maybe that's been symbolical for us anyway. An equilateral triangle, while it represents the essential prime nature of deity, fails to emphasize a certain factor which the Pythagoreans came to recognize. In this equilateral triangle, all the four-faced symmetrical solid, or the tetrahedron, all faces or all angles are equal. Now, in the Pythagorean thinking, this was not true of the nature of deity. Had all natures and parts of deity been eternally equal, there could not have been any end to the principle of equilibrium. And things which are in all parts equal lack the dynamic which arises from the stress of inequalities. Therefore, in the Pythagorean philosophy, deity in itself, in its own nature, is equal, but in its manifestation must always be unequal. Consequently, for the God that is knowable to man, that being which is essentially cognizable by its attributes or forces, there must be a symbol suitable to interpret the inequality of divine manifestation in nature. To achieve this, the Pythagoreans devised the concept of the right angle scaling, a triangle which was not an equal or equilateral triangle. In a scaling, a right angle scaling, there is one right angle and two acute angles. Therefore, the triangle is not perfect, but has its sides of unequal length. But in the case of the right angle scaling, there is one true right angle. This became to the Pythagoreans an appropriate symbol of the ways in which the powers of deity variously manifest on different levels of existence or being. Now, in the divine nature, we have a series of analogies which can be communicated to all the planes of human life. For example, we have three essential powers represented by the Trinity. These essential powers have variously been symbolized by the different races and peoples of the world in their religions and in their philosophies, creating a series of triads. These triads, not necessarily merely comprehending the essential nature of deity in abscondita, but of deity in objective manifestation. The ancients, therefore, conceived of a triangle or of a triune manifestation, which they considered as consciousness, intelligence, and force. Now, consciousness, intelligence, and force are not equilateral in their manifestation. On the same basis, we have another important triad, consisting of mind, matter, and form. Now, mind and matter, in their relationships to form, are not equilateral. We have another important triad, consisting in man, of spirit, soul, and body. Spirit, soul, and body are not regarded as equal. And certainly, in philosophy and theology, body would not be regarded as equal to soul. And soul, in turn, would not be considered as equal to spirit. Therefore, a triangulation of these qualities could not be equilateral. We have another important concept also. We have the concept of God, nature, and man. A very important one, which has been especially philosophized upon by the Chinese, who have gone to a great extent in their study of this subject. And when the Ikenobo and Nirvana schools of Japanese flower arrangement came into existence, we had an interesting example of this triadic symbolism, because the basis of all flower arrangements lies in the recognition of the three parts of the universe, heaven, earth, and man. Wherever you find a painting by a reputable Oriental artist, you will find heaven, earth, and man. You will find sky. You will find a little waterfall or a tree broken against the edge of the painting. And somewhere, you will find a little cottage or a house or a little boat or a sail or something that signifies or suggests man. We must have this triform division. And in the paintings themselves, you always have heaven, earth, and man from the very boundaries of the picture. You will always have heaven above as a wide border to the painting, as the one over there. You will have earth below as a much narrower border, which you cannot see because it is behind the couch. And between the two, you have the painting, and that is man. Now, when we know the picture, we put the wide border below and the narrow border at the top. But then again, we are much more materialistic than the Chinese. Therefore, to us, matter is much more basic than it is to them. To their minds, earth is the least part, heaven the greatest. To us, earth is a rather greater part, and heaven is a rather an abstract and hoped-for thing without any very clear definition. When an artist prepares to paint, he creates the pattern of heaven and earth and paints between these two extremes because he is man, he is the painter, and the painter is a product, and the painting itself is the product of the meaning of heaven and earth. Why? Because heaven and earth are spirit and body, and the artist unite to create soul, and soul becomes the painter of the picture. Therefore, we have these trinities wherever we have philosophy developing its proper forms and habits. In this concept, then, of heaven, earth, and man, we also have in the flower arrangement the flower, which is heaven, the leaf, which is earth, and the bud, which is man. And these must always be some way combined. And we have rocks, and we have little pieces of wood, and we have blossoms, and we have moss, we have all kinds of elements that are combined, always, however, to signify the relation of the three primary parts of the universe. As Goethe tells us in Faust, the man is suspended twixt heaven and earth, dominion wielding. So man becomes a very important and wonderful symbol. Not just the human being with his little personal arrogances and things of that nature, but man as a concept. Man as the child of heaven and earth. Man as the being who exists because of the union of two great principles in space. Man himself bearing witness to these principles which are locked within him, which disappear in his constitution, and do not again visibly or immediately manifest themselves. So we have another Pythagorean triad, father, mother, child. And the universe consists of father, mother, child. And these three are the basis of family. And family is the basis of society. And society is the basis of civilization. And civilization is the primary motion of man toward the improvement of himself. All so-called civilization is an expansion or growth of potentials within life. Then when we look at the child, we can say, where are the father and mother? They are vanished. They have disappeared. And the father and mother may never understand the child, and the child may never understand its parents. But somewhere in that child, there is the inevitable chemistry of father and mother. Just as in the water, the hydrogen and oxygen have lost their apparent identity and a new element results, so in the universe, all of the great creating and created polarities unite to produce a progeny. And this progeny we call symbolically soul or soul power. So we come back to a very interesting problem that comes very close to a great many human beings, and that is the study of soul itself. We have very little knowledge of the term as it is used broadly, generally, and rather loosely in our modern language.
We hear much about the soul. We hear of people who are good souls and others are kindly souls and others are miserable souls. And we hear also of the hope of the soul for salvation and the soul that's in it that shall die and all of these things. But just what the soul is, the book never gets around to telling us. And so it has variously been identified with spirit, or with mind, or with consciousness, or even on a scientific level, simply with force or energy as a moving or animating principle. But in the Pythagorean theory, we have a whole group of parallels which define each other and the slow emergence of what we may term the principle of analogy, by means of which we gain an understanding of one thing by studying its counterparts or its equals or its similitudes in other things. In the Pythagorean mathematics, then, we have spirit, matter, and form. And these become more or less a basic trinity, or a basic triad. And in this concept, spirit and matter, as father and mother, generate the principle of form. Now, humans, most people think of form and body as identical. And certainly they would say that bodies are forms, and forms are bodies, and that forms are built out of matter, and therefore that perhaps forms are merely complex patterns of matter. This is all right as far as it goes, but it leaves something out. It leaves out this thing which we have previously referred to as the numerative power of God. Because a form is a compound. All forms consist of two or more principles or energies, of which one of these principles is matter and the other is air. A form cannot exist of itself alone, and things which do not have a cohesive principle or an archetypal design inherent in them fall apart, because their forms are matter held together by binders. And the binders in these cases are archetypal design. Therefore, Pythagoras might have been fairly well stating it when he said that a form is a combination of mind and matter. Perhaps this is one of the simplest ways in which we can define it. Because the matter itself supplies the substances, but not the design. Therefore, a body must consist not only of material elements, but of an archetype, a drafting plan, a drawing or design, some principle, some power, which, as in the case of the snowflake, or of the small microorganism, which is a magnificent mystery of geometrical order, that all things consist, all forms consist of matter and mind, or matter and organization. Therefore, a form must consist of some chemistry of consciousness and unconsciousness, of things in themselves immovable and of things moved. So Plato gives us three orders of energies, in which he says that the lowest is that which is moved, or that to which motion is imparted, and in which motion itself is not inherent. The second, above or higher form, is called self-moving, in which the energy of motion is called inherent, or the being or creature moves of itself. And the third, or highest, is called the unmoved mover, which bestows motion upon all other things, yet is itself unmoved. The unmoved mover is obviously God. The self-moving is man, or the soul, and the moved is nature, or matter. Therefore, man will take various material elements and mold them into a dish or a cup. He moves them because they are not self-moving. Man, however, is self-moving because from an idea within himself, he is capable of molding this cup for himself. He is able to build himself houses and cities and towns. He is also able to move from place to place, and able through moral motion to move from condition to condition. He is therefore self-moving. He says, I will go, and he goes. He does not have to depend upon the motion of the winds or of the sea, except in a very negligible degree. The unmoved mover is that which, corresponding to God, extends energy to all things, yet is itself immovable upon its foundations. Therefore, that which, being unmoved, yet moves all other things, is supreme and superior. These qualities, again, relate to spirit, matter, and form. Spirit is the unmoved mover of all things. Matter is the moved. And soul, or form, is the self-moving, or that in which certain power of motion is inherent. It is called self-moving because it is not yet stabilized, and its energies are expended in motion, because it exists in a sphere of consciousness in which there is a place to go and a place to depart from, which is not true in the divine nature, which can never depart from itself or go to any place where it is not. This concept, of course, gets into a rather abstract field, but it still has value for us. But in the study of the Pythagorean proposition attributed to Euclid as his 47th proposition, we have, as we have said, a right-angled triangle. And we make a discovery, namely, that if we place the unit of three upon one side of the right angle, and the unit of four on the other side of the right angle, and we consider four to be the horizontal base, and three the vertical upright, then the hypotenuse, or the line which would extend at a diagonal to unite the terminations of the extremities of the lines of three and four, this line will measure 5. And therefore, we have in this right angle triangle 3 enclosing lines, one of the unit 3, one of the unit 4, and one of the unit 5. The unit 5 being the hypotenuse, or the line necessary to connect the extremities of the line of 3 and 4 by their divergent ends. This combining line of 5, if we square it, gives us the number 25. And the number 25 is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two lines. The square of 3 is 9. The square of 4 is 16. And the sum of these squares is 25, which is equal to the sum of the square of the hypotenuse. This is a peculiar equation because it shows us, for one thing, apart from the design entirely, that the square of 3 plus the square of 4 equals the square of 5, which is the essential point involved. But the mathematical formula for this equation has been variously applied to a great many subjects. Plutarch tells us, for example, that the square of 3, or the line of 3, one side of this unequal triangle, is equivalent to the god Osiris, that the 4 is equivalent to Isis, and that the 5 is equivalent to Horus, the divine child. This is a more or less sociological interpretation of the divine family in Egypt, but it still has importance to us scientifically and philosophically when we begin to understand the meaning of these 3 terms. Osiris, represented by the number 3 and also by the all-seeing eye, which was his glyph in the Egyptian hieroglyphical system, was considered by the Egyptians as a proper symbol of the divine power in its own nature. Isis, the wife sister of Osiris, was the mother of mysteries, the symbol of nature and of the earth, but much more than that, the symbol of the great hierarchical system of initiation. Now, Isis was the temple, was the sanctuary, the secret house, ruled over by the strange, mysterious master of the mysteries. Therefore, Isis is the virgin of the world, Sophia, Maya, the mother of Buddha, Mary, the mother of Jesus, the Blessed Virgin, Diana, goddess of the Ephesians, the Multimania, the Mata Deum, the mother of the gods. Now, in this concept also, Isis, on her shrine at Sais in Egypt, had inscribed upon the pedestal of her statue, "My veil no man hath lifted." Isis is not only the wife mother, but also the eternal virgin of the world, because she is the system of the ancient sacerdotal colleges. She is the soul mother, the alma mater. She is the mother of learning and of wisdom. And her sons are born and come forth out of the womb of her mystery. She gives birth to the adepts, to the learned, to the sages, to the scholars, to the wise. Yet, like the mysteries, remains forever a virgin. The symbolism, therefore, of Isis is far greater and more wonderful than we might first appear to recognize. And when we consider her as the symbol of nature and of the earth, we immediately recognize how the ancients understood this term. For we know that by them, the earth simply represented the house of the mysteries. The earth upon which we live and in the environments of which we unfold our various capacities and abilities is the great schoolhouse. It is the place of learning. It is the place of experience. It is the sphere in which we grow and are tried and are tested. And life itself is the great ritual of initiation into the mysteries. Now, out of life, out of growth, out of struggle, out of striving, and out of experience, we have the tremendous adventure of what the Pythagoreans call the acute angle of the right angle scaling. Inasmuch as this experience, this struggle for wisdom, contributes one of the footings, or one of the terminals, of these meeting and connecting lines relating to the generation of the power of the soul. Osiris, of course, represents in this same pattern heaven, the spiritual roots of things, and most of all, the esoteric doctrine itself, apart from its material institution. In other words, Osiris is the embodiment of truth, the personification of absolute wisdom, absolute strength, absolute will. Osiris, then, is the patron, or the master of the house of the mysteries. And the house, or the system of initiation, represents the female counterpart of wisdom itself. In other words, the universal spirit, being the divine energy of all things, impregnates the universe which bears the divine child. Consequently, man is born of heaven and earth. He is born inwardly of the spiritual energies of the creating power, and he is born outwardly of the vast cycles of generation and experience in the mundane sphere. He is born of truth and striving. He is born of reality and experience. He is born of spirit and matter. He is born of an internal mystery locked forever within himself. And he is released through the great experience of growing and learning. The ancients did not believe that when a child was born into this world, it was really conceived by its parents in the highest sense of the word. They provided its body, but the child itself was an immortal being in its own nature and in its own right. Therefore, heaven and earth became the foster parents of the child. And heaven gave it an inner life, and earth gave it a psychic nature and a capacity for growth. These two, then, heaven and earth, bring forth their own witness. For Horus, the divine child, is much more than merely the progeny of heaven and earth. He is more than merely a child to generate and perpetuate an order or kind. Horus is the avenger. Horus is the witness of his own parents. For in Horus, all that is to be attained or achieved by the invisible father and the essentially invisible mother, all these things are made manifest. Therefore, whoever has seen this child has seen the parents, because they are in it, and he is in them, and they are essentially one nature in three parts. Now, when we study this concept from the standpoint of the human being, we realize that spirit, or God, and body, or nature, must therefore generate. And the union of spirit and matter produces an interval or power between this mysterious compound which the ancients considered to be the world soul. Now, the nature of the soul, like the nature of the body, is a strange and involved thing. Because while the spark of the soul is bestowed by the divine soul, the Father, this soul must be brought to birth or brought to manifestation through the mystery of the Great Mother. Hence it is that the soul must pass through a certain prenatal epoch. It must be carried in the womb of the mysteries. It must be provided by the mysteries of nature and of the universe with certain materials and energies for its future manifestation. For this reason, the Eleusinian mysteries of Greece were celebrated upon 9 nights, each of these nights representing one of the divisions or months of the prenatal epoch. Later also, we have another interesting definition in the establishment of a triune set of mysteries. the three degrees of ancient secret schools, where it was said in those times that by 9 months of prenatal life, or during the 9 months of gestation, plus 3 degrees of the mysteries, the perfect human being was born. Man is born falling short, represented in old symbolism by a broken wheel with only 9 of its 12 spokes. Man, therefore, is represented as being conceived and brought to birth through 9 months of prenatal life and 3 degrees of initiation. The result of these two is 12, and 12 of the dodecahedron was the Platonic and Pythagorean symbol of the perfect human being. Now, in this problem, then, of the generation of the soul and its relationship to Isis, the great mother of mysteries, we come into some very interesting and constructive thinking. According to the Pythagoreans, the hypotenuse, or the line of 5, which by its square becomes 25, is composed of the union of 2 other numbers. It is composed of 3 and of 2, because the square of 2 is 4. And 4 is one of the lines of the original right-angle triangle. This again involves some rather involved symbolism, but for our purpose, the ancients regarded the mysterious symbol of the soul, a number 5, as generated from 2 and 3 brought together. In other words, it is generated from the deficiencies of the number 2 and the abundance of the number 3. It is composed, therefore, of duality and equilibrium. We heard before in one of the other lectures that the number 2 was the symbol of duality, or of division, and the number 3 of equilibrium. These 2 numbers, then, form the soul, which by nature of its own peculiar relationship is also represented as an oblique line. We mentioned this oblique line before in relation to one of the old mystery cults, in which it says that the degrees of initiation result in the individual being raised from the horizontal to the oblique, and from the oblique to the perpendicular. The oblique, of course, is the line of the hypotenuse. And, of course, the oblique is the symbol of soul, for its angle is between that of the vertical and of the horizontal. The vertical obviously represented to the ancient spirit. The horizontal represented matter. And the oblique represented man. Therefore, man begins to play to a series of analogies. Man becomes identical symbolically with form. He becomes identical symbolically with soul, and in the triad of consciousness, intelligence, and force, he is intelligence. In the triad of creation, preservation, and disintegration, he is preservation. In the term of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, he is Son. He is always the second power of the Trinity, because he represents, in each case, the point of oblique balance, or the point of polarity between the opposites. Of, therefore, wisdom, strength, and beauty, he is strength. Of will, wisdom, and action, he is wisdom. Of mind, soul, and body, of course, he is soul. He is whatever this middle quality may be. Creator, preserver, destroyer, he has to be preserved. And as such, he is intimately associated with the messianic mystery wherever it occurs, because he is associated with the second power of the Logos. Now, when we say that man is associated with all these things, we also mean that in some mysterious way, form is associated with all these things. And that form, consequently, is in principle the mysterious agency or quality of which man is the peculiar embodiment. Also, that man is strangely and wonderfully the projection into manifestation of soul. Consequently, we must try to understand, at least in part, how the ancients arrived at some of these calculations and why they so distributed these qualities in the universe. Soul, to the ancients, was not what we may consider it today, a synonym of spirit. To the ancients, soul was a product of generation. Soul was a being capable of birth, but not normally capable of death. It was therefore something generated, which having been generated, had an indefinite duration in time. Soul, therefore, originating in body, could survive body. This concept Pythagoras undoubtedly derived from Egypt, where the entire doctrine was ancient long before his time. The Egyptians recognized the soul as a compound entity composed of seven essential natures or parts, and that the soul of itself was created by the reaction of consciousness upon matter, or the mutual reactions of consciousness and matter. Thus it was called the child of striving. It was born from the mysterious impact of necessity. And so, to them, as a result, was intimately associated with what we term experience. Their experience results from the impact of life upon environment. Therefore, life in this part plays the first person of the Trinity, and environment represents the opposite polarity, and experience becomes the distillation or the progeny of life acting upon matter or environment. The soul, consequently, is a part of the being, which is gradually enriched and accumulated by the processes which the Greeks accepted in connection with the cycles of rebirth. Therefore, what we term the soul is an independent kind of being that grows up through the ages, is a life within man, having a spiritual parent and having a mysterious energy within itself. Soul might therefore be likened to individuality, which is between universality and personality. Universality is life infinitely diffused. Personality is life infinitely restricted or contracted. And between these two is individuality, which is a process in which life gradually conquers environment. Life gradually releases itself through the instruments which it has created. Growth, therefore, is an attribute of the soul and belongs to the number five, or the hypotenuse, inasmuch as growth must ultimately connect heaven and earth, or bring all opposites and in inconsistencies is a reconciliation. Guilt, therefore, is the square of the five, which contains hidden within itself the squares of the three and four. In guilt, the individual expands until he takes into himself the polarities of his own causation. It is an involved concept, but it tells us a great many interesting things. Let us assume for a moment that at some hypothetical time at the beginning of creation, the spark of life, which we call man, came into existence. This spark of life was the Osiris self, the divine monad. This was the numeration of man, which was to precede the extension of man through the cycle of the numbers. This spark, this divine seed, or as Pythagoras called it, this seminal essence, fell into the darkness of matter, its polarized opposite. And there it remained in the darkness through the great sleep of the gods, until in the dawn of the new day of manifestation, the light of heaven and the moisture of the earth, Osiris and Isis, light and moisture, energy and humidity, release the power of the germ. Here the three and the four, by their union, as heat or light and moisture, result in the loss of their own identities within a new being, and the generation of man takes place. Now this first primordial man was a very simple creature, and probably for many, many millions and hundreds of millions of years had no awareness of its own existence. During this time, however, and we can study minute and elementary creatures today to have some concept of the process. Gradually, the first power of the soul began to be released within the creature itself. And that first power of the soul, according to the Greeks, was the impulse to survive. It was the impulse to escape destruction, the impulse to preserve self in some strange and intangible manner. We find this impulse, as the Indian scientist Biscay observed, the Nobel Prize winner, we find this impulse even now in carrots and radishes and beets. We put them on a delicate electrical machine and we approach them with heat or a dangerous instrument. And although our eyes cannot see it, the instrument shows that the poor little beet or the squash or the radish tries to escape. It tries to the extent of a motion so minute that only electrical amplification can reveal it. But still, within it somewhere, it is aware of danger. It wants to live. So in the earliest experiences of life, creatures begin to develop something that is neither spirit nor matter. But this power, this gradually growing incentive to survive, this was regarded as one of the primary aspects of the soul. For the reason that the impulse to survive is not present in the divine nature because it is indestructible. It does not need to survive. It cannot be assailed. It cannot be destroyed. Nor does the instinct to survive exist in pure matter, because pure matter is without recognition of its own existence. Therefore, pure matter, absolute negation, has no instinct to survive because it has no quality of survival. except that which is bestowed upon it. It has no awareness. It has no concept of growth. Nor is there any limitation. It's susceptible of fear or anxiety within the divine nature. Therefore, this creature, because it is a separate thing, and because it is a compound, an alchemical mystery, because the three sides of the Pythagorean proposition are believed by the alchemists to represent the proportions of salt, sulfur, and mercury necessary in the production of the philosopher's stone. Thus, the philosopher's stone, being soul in itself, of which in the alchemical mystery mercury is the symbol, we have the dawning of something within this compound of spirit and matter, universal spirit, universal matter, uniting to generate individual and particular seedlings in space. These seedlings, because they have a separate existence, verge toward their own causes, or seek to escape from their own negations, or aspire towards the unfoldment of their own potential, because they are separate or distinct from the original nature itself. They are a generation in which the polarities are obscured, and these creatures are not aware of their own relationships to causes. In numberless cases, these primordial forms disappear. These primitive structures were destroyed or vanished away in the limbo of ancient time. The only thing that survived them was this something that was gradually building within them. This psychic energy, which was not destructible with their bodies. And within bodies, there then developed a formal principle. And this formal principle, reacting upon bodies, began to modify form or bodies. So that by degrees, bodies became merely vestments built around archetypes. And the archetype was, of course, the gradually unfolding conscious experience of the being itself. Thus man, in his growth, gave birth in the beginning to a psychic principle. And this psychic principle continued and was inherited from life to life and passed from body to body. And through the millions of years through which man has passed, this psychic principle has enriched. It has become capable of increasing independence of existence. This psychic principle is not man's spiritual nature derived from God, nor his body derived from the earth. This psychic nature is derived from the motion of a life through time, through environment. And constant reaction to environment has resulted in the existence of another factor called heredity. And heredity is nothing more nor less than ages of environment conditioning creatures. Therefore, what we call heredity is nothing but ancestral reaction to environment. For all things are moved from without and worked upon from without by environment, which is the number four, and are worked upon from within by consciousness, which is the number three. And this combination is forever intensifying or enlarging the fivefold nature of of the soul itself. So as time goes on, the soul develops qualities and attributes. It survives from life to life and expands from life to life, until it assumes gradually in the more highly civilized being the proportions of the Gnostic Anthropos, or Emerson's Overself, or Oversoul. It is the soul which through experience grows and drags the body with it.